It's the Opperman Report. Join digital forensic investigator and PI Ed Opperman for an in-depth discussion of conspiracy theories, strategy of New World Order resistance, high-profile court cases in the news, and interviews with expert guests and authors on these topics and more. It's the Opperman Report. And now, here is investigator Ed Opperman.
Okay, welcome to the Opperman Report. I'm your host, private investigator Ed Opperman. You can find me at Opperman Investigations and Digital Forensic Consulting through my website, emailrevealer.com, or you can just email me at oppermaninvestigations@gmail.com. If you like our show, be sure and check out our Patreon. We put up exclusive content on Patreon each month, but also, too, all the shows you hear Monday to Friday, AM, FM, radio, we cut out the commercials, and you can get them on Patreon ad-free, commercial-free, all kind of sponsorship-free. Our archives you can always find on Spreaker.com. You go there, put up new content on Friday nights. The rest of the week, we play repeats. That's real simple. Friday nights, it's new content, a live show exclusive for Spreaker on Friday nights. The rest of the week, we play repeats on Spreaker.com. Get an email notification anytime we put up new content. And there's a chat room. You can chat with other guests. I found this gentleman, Thos Judge, T-H-O-S Judge. And he's living down on his little island off of Spain. And he's written this book. It's called Nuclear Weapons, Fact or Fiction, Companion Guide to the Girl Who Spoke Sanskrit. Now, you could find him at his website, which is just thosjudge.com. And he's written several books that seem to be topics that this audience would be interested in. Mr. Judge, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. Tell us about yourself. Who is Thos Judge?
Well, I'm a retired IT consultant, management consultant, a retired professional musician, now living in Tenerife as a musician and a writer.
Now, that's interesting. Tenerife, how did you wind up there? Because you sound like you're Scottish, right? Right? Scottish.
I'm Scottish. Yeah. I ended up in Tenerife on holiday, and I liked it so much I never went home. And I've been living here 8 years now.
Fascinating. And they speak English there?
They speak Spanish here, actually. But lots of people speak English and French, Belgian. There's a lot of Belgian people here. French is widely spoken. German is widely spoken. Obviously, Spanish is the native language, but there's a few English people, quite a few English people, actually.
Yeah, back in the 80s, I went to Pamplona, Spain. I ran with the Bulls in Pamplona, and I fell in I fell in love with that town. I mean, the Spanish people, the women are so beautiful, and everything's so clean, you know. It's just the gardens, these huge gardens, you know. Beautiful, beautiful country. Now, we brought you on the show to talk about this nuclear weapons, fact or fiction. Give us an idea. What is the theory behind this book?
The theory behind the book is, well, not so much theory. The fact is that nuclear fission is not explosive. Now, nuclear weapons claim to use nuclear fission to create an explosion. But nuclear fission is not explosive. It's a slow process of nuclear decay. And in a nuclear power station, for example, nuclear fission needs a neutron flux to create a flow of neutrons that the isotope of uranium can capture, and the neutrons need to be slowed down using a moderator. Now, if you look at the design of the Hiroshima bomb, the little boy bomb dropped on Hiroshima on August the 6th, 1945, you can see from the design that there is no no flux and there is no moderator, which begs the question, how did they create any form of nuclear reaction using this device? Because the device it's called a rifle design. Basically, it's an artillery barrel which fires a pellet of uranium at a block of uranium. Boom. And supposedly there's a nuclear explosion from this, but it's actually scientifically impossible.
Now are there any nuclear scientists out there that have come up forward and agree with you?
Well, I wrote this book with a little help from a guy called Anders Bortman, who's a nuclear physicist from Sweden, who's now living in France, and he's retired now for 15 years. He has a website. In fact, he claims to be able to pay anybody who can disprove him $1 euros as a prize for disproving him. Now, I stumbled on this whole concept of nuclear weapons being a fiction way back in 1982, when on Christmas Eve, I went into a bar, and the only person in the bar in London, in Westminster, was an ex-Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Now, I won't use his name, but anybody who understands or remembers any history would remember a Prime Minister of the UK from the 60s and early 70s. He knew my father, and he knew my uncle, both prominent politicians in Scotland. I didn't know the guy, and I was, when I met him, I knew who he was, and I met him regularly for about 2 years. And one of the things, one of the first things he said to me was that the UK doesn't have a nuclear deterrent. It doesn't actually have a nuclear deterrent. And I said, why is that? He said, well, it's not really a problem because nobody else has got one either. Nuclear weapons, they don't work. We push the red button and nothing happens. And I said, well, I'm not sure if I disbelieve you or not, because I'm not going to tell you you're a liar to your face. But he said, no, Tom, go and research this. When you get the time, research it. So 30 years later, or more than 30 years later, I'm sitting in Tenerife, and I thought, right, I'm going to start researching this. Now, interestingly, I had already an idea for a fiction book, The Girl Who Spoke Sanskrit, in which there is a massive deception involving a weapon of mass destruction. And this book, The Girl Who Spoke Sanskrit, is, how would we describe it? It's an alternative history of the American Civil War in 1861 involving a poker tournament, golf lessons, and a massive deception. And stories about a girl called Flora Webster, a teenager. So inspired by an ancient Vedic poem, teenager Flora Webster plans to develop a weapon of mass destruction to avenge the killing of her mother. But when Texas is purchased by Prussia, she decides to use her talents to halt the American Civil War. This is a steampunk story involving love, poker, and golf. And it's a sequel to a book called Indian Affairs, which I wrote a few years ago. Now, Indian Affairs is an alternative history of the British Raj at the time of the Indian Mutiny in 1857. And the characters in this second book, Sanskrit, also appear in Indian Affairs. So the Indian Affairs book is about the mutiny in 1857, and it involves a steam-powered elephant, heavier-than-air ornithopters, a heavenly dragon, and a clockwork cast iron talking Queen Victoria sent to negotiate with the rebels. The story evolves in Indian Affairs, and I take the story much further forward in The Girl Who Spoke Sanskrit. And in order to answer questions, really, because I published these books a couple of years ago, and people said, but seriously, nuclear weapons don't exist. How can that be? I said, well, you need to understand the science. And I thought, okay, instead of repeating the same answers time and time again, I will write a companion guide. It's only about 30 or 40 pages, and it's not available as a paperback. I didn't see it was worthwhile making it as a paperback, only as an ebook, because it's got lots of links in it, hyperlinks to websites and things. One of the websites it's linked to is Stanford University, where I found descriptions of the two bombs that were used to end the Second World War. And if you understand nuclear physics and you look at the design of these bombs, you can see that it's not possible to create a nuclear explosion, especially when you understand that nuclear fission, and we're not talking about nuclear fusion here, we're talking about fission. Nuclear fission, which is the basis for these two devices that ended the Second World War, nuclear fission is not explosive. It's the very slow process of nuclear decay. For example, uranium-235, the isotope of uranium, takes 4.5 billion years to decay. The half-life is 4.5 billion years, which means if you take 100 tons of uranium-235, in 4.5 billion years, you will have 50 tons of uranium-235 and 50 tons of whatever it's transmuted into. So nuclear fission is not explosive, and in order to create a nuclear reaction in a power station, so in order to induce nuclear fission, because it does occur in nature, but it can be induced, and to induce it, you need a moderator to slow the neutrons down that create the reaction, and you need a source of neutrons to start the reaction, because without the moderator, the neutrons just fly off into space, and nothing happens. that don't hurt anybody. So how can a nuclear explosion in a bomb be possible? That's the first question.
Well, then, what do you think happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki and all those underground tests that we've seen on TV? I guess only on TV we've seen them, right? What are they exploding? What are they using?
Okay, right. Let's take the first bomb. The bomb over Hiroshima. This was a never tested device. The bomb used at Nagasaki was based on the technology developed at Los Alamos under the Manhattan Project. But the bomb used in Hiroshima had never been tested. And, of course, it's pointless testing it because nuclear fission is not explosive. And the device didn't have a moderator or a neutron flux. It was used in the hope of ending the Second World War. Very moral, very noble, and I'm glad it worked that way because it saved many lives. But the plan was, and I think General MacArthur was the guy who was running this show, the USSR had been asked to help the United States invade Japan. But the USSR had a peace treaty with Japan. It also would take 18 months to mobilize the troops to do this invasion, and they wanted the war to end quickly. So they faked it. They faked it. Japan had been napalmed. 63 major cities had been napalmed. And remember, Japan in 1945, the buildings were all paper and wood, maybe with a few stone buildings. And if you look at the photographs of Hiroshima, you will see stone buildings are standing. But these supposedly powerful megaton blasts of nuclear explosion could have wiped everything out, but didn't. The buildings that were made of stone are still standing. The buildings that were made of paper and wood were already burnt by napalm. The whole country was napalmed. Now, if you think about a nuclear explosion creating such a powerful blast, it should also have created a tsunami. There was no tsunami. There's a river running through Hiroshima. There was no tsunami. The railways, not the railways, the tram network was running 3 days later. Now, steel melts about 12,000 degrees centigrade, and it's claimed that the blast created a temperature of 6,000 degrees centigrade, so there shouldn't have been any tram rails anywhere. They would have melted. But yet, 3 days later, the trams are running in Hiroshima. How is this possible?
You know, I got to tell you, this is not the first time I've heard this theory, okay? And as far as Hiroshima and Nagasaki, have you heard that story about the, I think they called them Freemasons. There were a couple of gentlemen that were Freemasons that walked out of there and had detonated some kind of a handheld device, like a suitcase-type device. Have you ever heard that tale?
No, I haven't heard that.
Okay. Yeah, it's obscure, you know, and I haven't tried to look it up again, but it's just a tale that I heard one time. Now, what about then the bombings that we see these underground tests in Nevada?
Well, I believe Walt Disney Corporation may have been involved in these. Huh. Basically, these are TNT, petroleum, napalm, if you want to call it napalm. Hydrogen gas, in order to create a fantastic explosion. Where are the witnesses? We're talking now of 70 years ago, 75 years, I think, maybe the Second World War ended, and these tests were run in the 40s and 50s. And there were some underground atoll tests and things. But basically, if you put petroleum and hydrogen gas in an explosion and put some uranium in there to create some fallout of a nuclear toxicity, you can simulate something. What is a scientific fact? You've got to follow the science here. Nuclear fission is not explosive. And if you want to create a nuclear reaction, induce a nuclear fission reaction, you need a moderator and a nuclear flux. A source of neutrons. Without that, first of all, without those two items, you cannot induce a nuclear reaction. And secondly, it's not explosive. So how could you have a bomb?
And, you know, it's interesting because just recently, if you recall, on the news, I think it was some town in the Middle East, there was an accident, explosion, and the explosion was a mushroom cloud, just like we see in those nuclear bombs, you know? Now, what about, like, wouldn't there be whistleblowers, like a nuclear scientist who would want to come forward and say, hey, this doesn't work?
Well, that was, interestingly, when I was speaking to this ex-Prime Minister of the UK, this is one of the things I said, but he said, remember, we're all signed up with the Official Secrets Act here in the UK. Yeah. It's a bit different in the United States. I think in the United States, you might end up with a horse's head and get better, or you might end up with your kids being abducted or something strange, allegedly. I'm not saying that would happen. But people have reasons not to talk. Certainly in the UK, the Official Secrets Act would prevent this. But, you know, we're now talking 75 years after the event. Most of the people involved in this are dead now. So we're probably into a third or fourth generation. I'm 63, born in 58. My parents were alive then, but even my dad, too, was very skeptical of many things, including the space program, the moon landings. He said, this is Walt Disney that's done this, which was only something that he told me when I told him I'd been talking to an ex-Prime Minister of the UK that he knew. And he said, yeah, well, this is just Walt Disney. Don't worry about it.
When an ex-Prime Minister
of the UK tells you that there is no red button to push, or there's a red button, and if you push it, nothing happens, it's pointless.
We've done several shows on the moon landing. If you really get into the details on that, it really is far-fetched to believe that we pulled that off. We had Dave McGowan with his wonderful work on it, and then that other fellow who is one of the more notorious debunkers of that story. I'll tell you an interesting story, though, to support your thing going on here, this book. My daughter went to school, and when she was in the third grade, there was another parent that worked at the school, that had a kid at the school. And we're at a party one day, and he described that he worked for the Central Intelligence Agency. He worked for the CIA. And when we were talking about what his day-to-day duties were, he said that he would travel around the world and locate nuclear scientists and pay them money not to develop nuclear bombs. Okay. Now this kind of fits in with your story. You know what I mean? Like, why aren't these people coming forward? Well, because they're getting a nice fat paycheck from the U.S. government, you know?
Well, I guess it's probably cheaper to take people right. off than it is to bomb people, you know?
Right.
But, you know, the interesting thing is, and I'm happy that the world is the way it is, only allegedly two bombs have ever been used in earnest. And we've had conflicts since 1945, and bombs could have been used, but they haven't been. Now, maybe some of the politicians may want to think that they have moral integrity and we look up to them. The reality of it is there ain't no bombs. That's why they were never used.
Now, why would, like, Russia and China and other nuclear power, supposedly countries, Israel, South Africa, why would they go along with all this?
Détente. Foreign policy, keep the balance of power. You know, I mean, it's something that works. What my concern really is, well, I don't actually have a concern about it because I don't really concern myself about much. The amount of money that's been spent on nuclear programs in the UK, just I'm only interested in the UK here. The US is not my country, although I did work in Manhattan for a while. The money that the UK has spent on nuclear development, where has this money gone? Because the scientists involved know that nuclear fission is not explosive. This is why they say we've had lots of tests. But, you know, an engineer will only test something once or twice to make sure it works. There's been 2,000 nuclear tests. And these guys are not stupid guys, but they're getting paid by the government to do something. So, you know, you shut your mouth. I worked in the government. I worked as a consultant, management consultant for the British government. So you shut your mouth. Some of the jobs you do are just stupid. You think they could do this in a minute, but okay, we'll have a 3-year contract and some money. Keep your mouth shut. Take the money. Take the money and run.
And I guess the money goes to the defense contractors. They kick some back and don't campaign contributions, some stock options back and forth. I could just imagine. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. Mm. You know? And when there's a lot of money involved, it's usually not honest people around. You know what I mean? No. Usually don't buy too many honest people. Now, what about, there's another thing, too. I once heard another story, too, that nuclear waste, or that nuclear, the water that's used to cool nuclear power plants, that's not really harmful to humans. What is your conclusion on that?
Okay, well, the way a nuclear power station works, because we know nuclear power stations do actually work, right? They generate electricity. But interestingly, what happens is a nuclear reaction creates heat, and the moderator, so you've got the water, you've got normal H2O water as a moderator. It heats up, and it's contained because it can become radioactive. And it's contained, and then there's a heat sink so that you can heat water on the exterior of the containment. And that water is then warmed up to create steam, and it powers a steam turbine to generate electricity. So we're actually not living in the age of nuclear. We're not living in the nuclear age. We're living in the steam age still, which is why I thought it was quite an interesting topic to build into a steampunk novel. So in terms of water that leaks from a nuclear power station is contaminated. I can't say my knowledge is sufficient, because I think maybe you're talking about Fukushima here. But it is known that the water has escaped.
Well, it's funny you mentioned it's funny you mentioned Fukushima, because I had on this show Operation Hope. And he wasn't on here to talk about Fukushima. We were on to talk about the different programs they do to help people in poor people in general, and just people who can't feed themselves, and people in crisis, and disaster response. And he had been to Fukushima a couple of days after the accident, and he had a nuclear film badge dosimeter to find out that, and there was no registered radiation on his badge. It was just normal.
I've heard this.
You've heard that too.
I've heard this. I know somebody who went to Fukushima to work. In fact, Anders Bortman is the guy who helped me write this book.
Yeah.
He went there, he flew to Fukushima. There's an airport nearby, and he said the radiation on his badge was higher when he went through the security checks at the airport than it was at the site. But of course, we're talking about the air radiation and soil radiation. Water radiation, where the water has leaked out, it would have some contamination. But I would have thought that the volume of water was so small it would have been diluted in the sea. But I've read stories or articles that, you've got fish with three heads off the coast of California. I don't know. I don't tend to believe everything I read in the newspapers. And I haven't had time or the inclination to research this. I was more concerned about justifying my position on nuclear weapons to support my steampunk story.
Well, since you've written the book, have any whistleblowers come forward to you and say, oh boy, Thos, let me tell you this, let me tell what's going on over here?
No, nobody has. In fact, most people think I'm a lunatic because I talk about this. There's a couple of Facebook groups I'm a member of, and they're physics oriented and quantum mechanics oriented, and I have an interest in this stuff, so I join them. And when the subject comes up, I'll say, guys, nuclear fission, it's not explosive. You're not a scientist. You don't know what you're talking about. I said, listen. Why do you know I'm not a scientist? Because you're a musician. I said, listen, many scientists are musicians. Lots of people don't admit to doing very many things. One of the things I don't like to admit to doing is having been an investment banker. I did work in investment banking. It's not something I'm proud of, but, it's, I don't tell people. So you don't know I'm an investment banker until I tell you. I may actually have studied physics. In fact, I did study physics. I did an Open University course in the UK on nuclear physics. So does that make me a scientist or not? Maybe I was a patents clerk or a post office clerk in an earlier career. Yeah. Einstein was a patents clerk and a post office clerk. He wasn't a scientist until he won a Nobel Prize for Science for his theories. Yeah, and then he became a scientist.
Yeah,
but he must have been a scientist to start with.
Yeah, and in the U.S., it's pronounced patents clerk for the patents office, Einstein.
Yeah,
and they actually wanted to close down the patents office because they thought everything had been invented back back in that era.
Yeah,
they were going to close it down. Yeah. And we're with Thos Judge. And we're talking about, first we've been talking about his book, the one about the nuclear weapons.
Nuclear weapons.
Yeah, Fact or Fiction, Companion Guide to the Girl Who Spoke Sanskrit. But I wanted to get his opinion here on the moon landing. He wrote another book called Asteroids. I love this. Only a lunatic would believe that man has set foot on the moon. And I tell you, you know, people just look at the surface, but if you really examine this detail step by step, how did you come to your conclusion?
Well, again, my old dad, who was an aerospace engineer, 1969, I am 11 years old. I said to my dad, "Hey, can I stay up tonight and watch the moon landing?" And he said, "No." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Because it's all a load of, it's all a load of rubbish." Mm. I said, "It can't be." He said, "It is. Believe you me, son, this is staged." He said, "We don't have the technology to get back. Mm. We can get there, but we don't know how to get back." He said, "The big problem is getting back through the Earth's atmosphere." I said, "Oh, I've been watching about this. The heat shields and everything." He said, "No, son, it's not happening, and you're not staying up. You've got to go to school tomorrow." I said, "But this is the most important thing that's happened to mankind." He says, "No, it's not. It's a fake." And that was it, and I had to go to bed. So after I wrote my book about nuclear fission, nuclear weapons, facts of fiction, I thought, okay, I'm in the mood to do another expose of something. And I decided to tackle the moon landings. It makes me really sad because I was 11 in 1969 and I wanted to be an astronaut and I wanted to be a pilot. I did actually learn to fly, and that was great. But to be an astronaut, as I got older, I thought, I'm not sure I would want to do that, even 10 days in space. The name Asteroids for the book is AFF because it's about human bodily functions. My take on this was, is it actually possible for somebody to go to space and spend 10 days up there without having a poo-poo? And if you did have a poo-poo, you'd be sitting on it for 10 days, and you'd end up coming back to Earth with the problem called asteroids, same as hemorrhoids. Mm. But it's what astronauts get. But on a more serious note, if you look at the NASA website, and it's well constructed. You can see the design of all the Apollo craft and the Gemini Mercury craft. I won't go into too much detail on this, but the biggest thing that struck me was that the Apollo spacecraft, the capsule, is connected to the command module unit with the engine, and there's a load of pipes running outside both units in and out to cool and provide oxygen. So when the capsule separates to come back through the Earth atmosphere and it turns its heat shield towards the ground so that it doesn't burn up, there's all these open holes around the thing which would cause the capsule to burn up. That's the most striking thing. Notwithstanding the fact that NASA have lost the data tapes for all the moon missions,
yeah.
It's as if it never happened. In fact, it probably didn't. So in a nutshell, I started off with some cynicism injected into me by my dad in 1969. And as I got older and became more cynical myself, and looking at nuclear weapons being a hoax, what's the chances the moon landings were a hoax? After all, my dad knew what he was doing, and he said, we can get there, but we can't get back. He wouldn't send anybody there. He wouldn't come back. The Russians never sent anybody. Only America.
Yeah, and at the time, the Russians said that it was a hoax, too. They stopped saying that, but they did say it at the time for a short period.
Well, I remember Apollo 11 leaving Cape Canaveral or Cape Kennedy. I was at school. We listened to a radio broadcast. I was at school in Scotland. It was the middle of the afternoon. The teacher said, "This is very important. We shall listen to this." And we had the BBC on one channel. And another radio with an English language version of a Russian program. And Patrick Moore was a famous astronomer, and he was talking about whatever on the BBC channel. But there was a guy on the Russian channel, he said,
we're monitoring, we have a blip on our radar, we're monitoring the orbit, and they claim to have left Earth's atmosphere. And we can see no evidence of anything leaving Earth's atmosphere. And I thought at the time, I thought, well, you know, my dad said that, you know, you're not going to be able to see this because it's a load of rubbish. So, you know, the truth will set you free. So what is the truth? You know, when somebody tells you that NASA have lost all the data tapes, it's as if it never happened. You've got to start thinking. But, you know, you asked me a question earlier, what about all the whistleblowers? I think there was something like 200,000 people worked on the space program, just at Cape Kennedy. And they've obviously kept quiet about it, but obviously they got paid some money.
Another program, yeah, with huge budgets, yeah. You know, just hand over fist money. Now, what about, did you see in the past 6 months or so, or 9 months, some footage came out it came out on the internet, and it was all kind of clipped together, but it was definitely film footage from that period of time that showed all kind of staging of the astronauts and sets and props and things. Did you catch that? Because it was shut down pretty quickly.
There's some stories that Captain Stanley Kubrick was responsible, but they made a film. Somebody made a film called Capricorn One,
yeah,
which was about a fake space program, and they were, and somebody broke into the set on a chase, and they were filming a simulated moon landing exploration. One of the things I did notice, though, I mean, I haven't been back to my book, Asteroids, for a while to refresh myself of my research, and it was quite intensive, the research I did on that, especially looking at the NASA stuff. But one of the I drive an American car. I've currently got a Wrangler. I had a Jeep Cherokee before when I was living in the UK. The design of the Lunar Rover was based on, guess what, a Jeep. Now, the Jeep has a very heavy metal chassis. And space is at a premium when you launch something. I think NASA are trying to tell us that they sent a one-ton chassis to the moon with tires filled with air. Now, the moon's a vacuum. The space is a vacuum, and there's a vacuum on the moon. I think the tires would have popped as soon as it got out of the lunar excursion module. And also, the storage space in the lunar excursion module isn't sufficient to store something the size of a Jeep chassis.
The cost of that little dune buggy Jeep go kart was something like $700,000 for in 1969 money. So that, you could have made it out of solid gold. And it's funny too, you were mentioning Capricorn One. In one of the James Bond movies, they show him and he's escaping the assassin, evil guys, or whatever.
Yeah.
And he goes through a set where they're filming the moon landing, and then the guys are no. You're into this kind of physics and science and stuff. Now, what if this was, if they were up in space with no gravity or less gravity than Earth, and in this vacuum, wouldn't there? Why would they be in slow motion? Wouldn't they be moving faster? Like if they jumped, wouldn't they jump real fast and be able to run real fast?
I think the moon's gravity is something like 1/6 of the Earth. So when you jump up, you go higher. Although you're wearing heavier stuff, but
what would make you move in slow motion?
Well, I mean, the possibility is that anything that the astronauts were doing was actually filmed underwater, and that's why it's in slow motion. But I don't really have an opinion on what it would be like on the moon. I hadn't really thought about that. I was more concerned about how did it get back. Now, actually, I read something very recently, and it's not in my book. They calculated the payload of fuel for the to launch from the moon to get back to the orbiting command module. But they had miscalculated the mass of the moon, and therefore the gravity and the pull. So, in fact, they didn't have enough fuel. According to the NASA calculations, they didn't have enough fuel to take off and reach the command module. That's not in my book, and I haven't verified any of this yet. The space program is a very complicated project. So there's many stages, and you've got to get into space. You've got to orbit the Earth. You've got to target the moon. You've got to get to the moon. You've got to orbit the moon. You've got to land on the moon. You've got to get back. There's so many things that you could pick holes in. And I think, for me, again, it's like the nuclear weapons factor fiction. You take the design, if you can find it, and it's publicly available, of the bombs, and you ask yourself the questions, with the basic knowledge that you have, is this thing going to work? So it's the same with the Apollo missions. You look at the design of the space capsules. These things would have gone up on the way back into the Earth's atmosphere with all these open holes that they had for the cooling and for the drinking water. But you know, one of the interesting things is, if you drink 2 liters of water a day, and we should drink 3 or 4, but I mean, you drink 2 liters of water. 2 liters of water is 2 kilograms. Okay, a kilogram is 2.2 pounds. You know, after 10 days in space, just drinking 2 liters of water a day, you're going to have 20 liters. You're going to have 20 kilos of urine flapping around your legs, unless you can get it out of your spacesuit. Now, the earlier space program, the Gemini and Mercury ones, these guys went into space for 5 hours. And I think the longest one was about 14 days, but that was just a one-off. Allegedly, it was a 14-day thing. But, and, of course, they didn't go very high. The altitude they reached was not what we would call out of space. Mm. Except maybe one of the Gemini missions, which it went considerably higher, probably about as high as the space station orbits now. But remember, the Apollo mission, they had to go to the moon. It's 250,000 miles away. So, but the basic issue of bodily functions and the ability to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, it's going to compromise somebody's health.
Nothing that always struck me is they're walking around in that moon dust, you know, that dirt, you know, and it was so thin, and they're getting on their, you know, their shoes, their boots, you know, they're jumping around, dancing in that stuff, you know, and then they're going to get back into the spaceship, right, and they're going to be in zero gravity in a little while. All that dust is going to be floating around. They'd be choking on it. They would be floating everywhere in their eyes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just they've been hosing off or a way to wash that stuff off.
I think it may have vacuum, but the thing that struck me was that both these astronauts, well, we're talking about Apollo 11 to Apollo 17, so but each human landing on the moon, these guys, Apollo 11, let's just take Apollo 11, they had been awake for 27 hours. Mm. I mean, that's pretty stressful. Staying awake for 27 hours. I mean, I know I've done it on a party weekend, but, you know, you go to a mission to the moon, right, and nobody's ever been there before, right? No, they haven't even test-landed anything. 27 hours on the moon, and then you're going to take off again and try and, for the first time, you know, join up with an orbiting satellite, an orbiting command module. I mean, it stretches credibility a little bit. And I know military pilots, they get substances to keep them awake and so on and so forth. But really, the fatigue and the stress, I just don't believe it. The human factors alone tell me that this is dubious. Mm-hmm. And then there's other factors like technology. It's not going to get you back. I mean, 1969, you're not going to get back. The computer on board there was like a very basic computer. I mean, we have 100 times more technology in your mobile phone. This is an often quoted thing. Your mobile phone's got more technology in it than the Apollo missions ever used. So.
Yeah, I just as a kid, you know, we're about the same age. I'm 59. And so I was, I was into that stuff, you know. The following missions, you know, you followed every single one of them. And I recall one when they would have those splash landings, you know, into the ocean.
Mm.
And it was chaos because they couldn't find where the capsule had landed in the ocean. Yeah. They were searching for it, right. And I asked my mom, I says, well, wait a second, but how could they not know where this thing is? And she says, well, the ocean is so big. The ocean is huge. And I just stopped it up. But wait, but they had constant contact all the way on the other side of the moon. That's way bigger than the ocean. Mm. How did they not lose it then? It just makes no sense, you know?
Well, one of the flippant comments I put in my book, it made me chuckle when I did my proofreading, was he spoke to President Nixon from the moon.
Right.
Now, I can't even speak to my mother in Scotland from Tenerife on my mobile phone. The conversation goes like this, and it goes like this for most conversations on a mobile phone. Hello? Can you hear me? Are you there? Can you hear me? Are you there? Is there anybody there? Can you hear me, Mom? There was none of that with Nixon and Armstrong. They phoned President Nixon from the moon in 1969. But I can't phone Scotland from Tenerife 50, 60 years later.
Yeah, and the TV footage, the TV transmission that far, it's just ridiculous. Now what about, there's a lot of people now, especially if you go on YouTube, you know, and they examine all the space station footage. And some of it is where they debunk the space station. And some of it's pretty convincing. This is the business about putting hairspray in the hair to look like the hair is sticking up, and sometimes you see like a little blip of water come up and all kind of stuff like that. Have you been studying that as well?
No, I haven't. But I have read things which suggest that the space station is actually some very large balloons orbiting at 150 kilometers up. What was it? Something I was going to point out. Gosh, forgotten. Remember, the space station's in low Earth orbit.
Right.
It's not out of space. The other thing, it came back to me and just, I must be getting seen out in the orbit. So
I the same thing happens to me, man. Yeah.
Senior moments. NASA. No, this is somebody pointed out to me, a photograph of NASA, NASA headquarters. There's a massive film studio there.
Right.
Why do they need a film studio? This is the elephant in the room, isn't it? So, anyway.
Yeah, they got a huge operation. What do you make of these, like Elon Musk and Bezos with their flights now? Have you looked into that?
Well, I just look at nothing. Well, Musk launched a Tesla car. And orbit of the Earth, I just think that's a meat cake. As for Jeff Bezos, well, he's the chairman of Amazon, and Amazon are publishing my book, so I shouldn't.
That's right. They'll pull the book if you say anything. Yeah. Okay. Well, we only got a couple of minutes left. What do you want to leave us with? We talked about the nuclear. Hoax, I guess you might call it, right? Asteroids, only a lunatic would believe that a man has set foot on the moon.
Yeah.
And the other one is a nuclear weapons fact or fiction companion guide to the girl who spoke. Well, what would you like to leave us with?
Well, I call these are fact books separate from my fiction books. The fact books are part of a series called Hidden Agendas. And one of the hidden agendas I also wrote a book about when it started was about viruses. And I said, you know, an idiot's guide to viruses. And I thought, I don't know anything about viruses. I'll study it. I'll write my notes and then I'll publish it and somebody else can read it. An idiot's guide to viruses. You know, this is another hoax. It is another hoax. It's, you know, it's just people, control. It's control and disinformation and trying to keep, I mean, I think we can safely say a large percentage of the population, maybe you're not stupid, but just too lazy or not interested in finding out about things. And other people, like me, are cynical and question everything. I am the original Doubting Thomas. So I like to know the truth. So, well, that's really it. I don't understand why governments can't tell the truth.
Well, yeah, and that's usually dollar signs, you know, that that come in the way, you know. But Mr. Thos Judge, thank you so much. People could find you at thosjudge.com. And once again, the books are called Asteroids, Only a Lunatic Would Believe That Man Has Set Foot on the Moon. And the other one is Nuclear Weapons, Fact or Fiction, Companion Guide to the Girl Who Spoke Sanskrit. Mr. Judge, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good night.